I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. People predicted that the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court would be contentious, but the biggest debate isn't about his views on women's reproductive rights or whether a sitting president is immune from prosecution. It's over alleged sexual misconduct back in the 80s. Today we'll ask you whether accusations from that far back should keep him from a seat on the highest court in the land. Then, in aviation's early days, women in this country were determined to enter the arena of airplane racing. We'll learn about five tenacious trailblazers who competed in the most dangerous sport of its time and proved to be as good as the men. We get you up to date after this hour's news. President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is facing new accusations this week from a second woman over his sexual conduct, this time at Yale. The accusation, Kavanaugh is said to have exposed himself at a party. The nominee has fired back, lashing out at smears and a grotesque and obvious character assassination. Meantime, Kavanaugh's original accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, is set to testify Thursday in Washington. So what do you think? How should the U.S. Senate proceed with Judge Kavanaugh's nomination? You have the floor along with our two guests here who will help us guide us along the way. First, our phone number, 816-235-2888. That's where you can reach us, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. And meanwhile, our guests in the studio with me here, Brenda Bethman is director of the UMKC Women's Center. Brenda, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Kyle Velty is an associate professor of law at the University of Kansas. Her work focuses on the intersection of sexuality, gender, and the law. And it turns out that she went to school with Christine Blasey Ford. And Kyle, nice to have you as well. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor, tell us a little more about how you know Christine. What's your relationship with her?
You know, I don't know her personally at all. Mm-hmm. The school that the Holton Arms School is a 10-year school from 3rd to 12th grade. I was in 4th or 5th grade when she was a sophomore in high school, so I didn't know her personally. But I did sign on to the letter of more than 1,000 alums that have signed a letter of support for Dr. Blasey Ford, mostly calling for a fair process in this nomination hearing process, as well as supporting all survivors of sexual assault.
I gather, did you know anything about this incident at all?
At the time that it was alleged to have happened, not at all, no.
Okay. You signed a letter of support, so that's on the record here. So while we're waiting for calls to come in, Brenda Bethman, based on what you know now, how do you regard the nomination? How do you size it up?
I guess that's a hard one to answer, but yeah. I do think that
a lot of people are struggling.
Kyle and I were actually talking about this a little bit in the waiting room earlier. So to me, the biggest issue that we have here is, regardless of which allegations are true and which are not and what actually happened, it's clear that Judge Kavanaugh and most of our public officials came of age in these institutions that were just hotbeds of misogyny. And they were not taught to respect women. They were taught to treat women like objects. And I don't see any acknowledgement of that on the part of the folks who are having the who are supporting him or having the conversation.
Judge Kavanaugh would certainly take exception to what you're saying there, though, I assume.
That school was...
Well, that he was raised without not having proper respect for the opposite sex.
He might. I would mm-hmm. disagree with him.
Yeah.
If you look at the yearbook quotes that have come out, if you look at the way the Yale clubs acted in the 1980s, I mean, if you look at the movies we were watching in the 1980s, it's kind of not possible for that not to have happened. And so to me, that seems to be the biggest barrier to women's equality, is that our leading officials are men who were raised in these institutions and aren't feminist.
Professor Velty, how are you seeing it?
I think the nomination is troubled at this point, particularly with the additional allegations that may be coming forward later this week. After Judge Kavanaugh's had the opportunity to present lots of positive character witnesses, for me, this is about process and fair process. There's no hurry here. Last time there was a nominee, he sat for almost a year without a hearing. So we do have time. And this is about normalizing assault. If we treat it as, you know, an indiscretion of a 17-year-old and we should look past it, that really normalizes this kind of activity as something that everyone does. And it's certainly not something that every boy does. And so these kinds of conversations are critically important, not only the larger issues around gender equality, but also for this particular nominee, right? He is interviewing for a job. And these kinds of character questions are pertinent to anyone who's applying for any job. And so mm-hmm. we need to remember that at the end of the day, he's applying for a job and one of the most important jobs in our country that has a lot of control over many people's lives, bodies, and fates. And for that reason, it's absolutely appropriate for this process to take into consideration these allegations.
And maybe the big question here is whether the acts of a teenager should disqualify someone from a position, you know, any position later in their adult years. Brenda, what do you think? I mean, should your future hang on what you said and did when you were 17?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it should hang on what you did and said at 17, but the later response to it. And in none of these cases do we see people saying, yes, I did this thing and it was wrong and I'm very sorry about it and I've spent my life trying to atone for it. That doesn't seem to ever happen. It's just denial, denial, denial. And so, people who don't, who want to outlaw abortion say girls who get pregnant at 17 should have to live with their mistakes. And mm-hmm. that's a big thing to live with. And it's for the kid, too. So I think there's a double standard. Again, we were talking about this earlier, not just for men and women, but for white men and boys of color. So when kids, you know, when the Central Park gang, that didn't happen, but when that happened, everybody was like, yeah, they should go to jail for life. We send juveniles to jail for life sentences. Mm-hmm. So why is it different for a certain group of people?
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Professor Velty.
Yeah, and I would just to add on to that, that we're not talking about general indiscretions as a teenager, right? To me, an indiscretion as a teenager is maybe drinking too much beer and toilet papering someone's house, toilet papering someone's house, or ding-dong ditch, or making prank phone calls. We're talking about a crime of violence. And so I think that we need to distinguish between what kinds of indiscretions we're overlooking or saying you get a pass for, mm-hmm. And also who we're giving passes to, right? We're typically giving passes to affluent white boys who circulate in these circles of power, and we're not giving passes to boys of color like Trayvon Martin or Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm. There's also this lingering question here of who to believe here. Judge Kavanaugh says categorically this didn't happen. We're going to hear later on this week from Christine Blasey Ford about what she views as what occurred here. I mean, how do you weigh the scales of justice when you have two people with fundamentally different views of what occurred here, Brenda?
So in my role as an advocate, my instinct is always to believe survivors. And I don't really have anything to add to that, actually.
Yeah. Because why?
Because we know that most women who and men too who come forward are not lying. There's a misperception in the public that sexual crimes have a higher false reporting rate. They do not. It's I think around 2% or whatever the rate is for all other crimes.
So it's fundamentally non-existent, what you're saying, this idea of falsely
right.
reporting a crime like this.
It fundamentally does not exist. And no one is going to come forward with these stories if they're lies when they know what's going to happen afterwards. Her story follows the same narrative that always happens. Mm-hmm. So she comes forward, she tells the story. Next thing you know, she has to go live somewhere else with her kids because people are threatening to kill her. Mm-hmm. Who does that?
Mm-hmm. This idea that these stories are not misrepresented, that there's this 2% rate of falsely reporting crimes like this. How do we know that? What kinds of research has been done in this area?
Those are the FBI statistics. And I will say I don't know exactly how they collect them, but those are the statistics from the FBI. And I assume that they don't have an incentive to make those up.
Yeah. How do you balance the scales of justice here, Professor, as you look at one person saying one thing, the other person saying just the opposite?
2 points on that I'd like to make. The first is when we talk about balancing the scales of justice, it's critical to remember we're not in a court of law, right? We're in a hearing where the senators have to hear everything and decide who they believe. And secondly, this is why an independent investigation, I think, is critical. Let's gather all the facts. Let's give them to the Senate Judiciary Committee so they can weigh them. Let's hear from all the witnesses that are willing to come forward. Let's talk about subpoena power and hear from witnesses who may not want to come forward. But we don't have to prove anything by preponderance of the evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt. Again, this is a job interview.
I was going to say, this is not a criminal trial.
Absolutely
right?
Not.
This is something very different
than
that.
That's exactly right. It's testimony, and at the end of the day, the senators get to decide who they believe. So let's get all those facts. Well, we won't get that through just questioning from a very partisan Senate Judiciary Committee. This independent investigation by the FBI would be a critical piece of the FOIA process. And again, he's interviewing for a job, so what boss wouldn't want to know whether these allegations have been made and hear about all of them before you decide to give someone a job of this stature in particular, of this power?
We're talking about Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Who do you believe? How should the U.S. Senate proceed with this case going forward? 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jeff from Kansas City, Kansas, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to respond. You were talking about balancing justice, and I agree that this is just in the court of conversation now rather than in law, which is really unfortunate that the information and the investigation should have begun a couple of months ago that probably could have eliminated much of this discussion. But it seems like it just fits into the whole discussion about if you're a white male that was raised in the last generation or so, then you're obviously guilty because you're ignorant of the misogyny of some people. And it seems like that's being imposed and discussed as the main reason to question Brett Kavanaugh. And in reality, Brett Kavanaugh has only been heard like on one station as to what his response is. And the questions of the allegations have been many, but very few have been discussed. So I just want to point out the fact that our nation has two wonderful historical facts. One is that initially in natural law and now in case law, we support the fact that people are innocent until proven guilty, whether it's in the media or in the courtroom. And now we have the Me Too movement, which is exposing the number of those who are misogynists and who have taken advantage of people.
Right.
But to throw everybody in the same category, to me, is a direction, and it really does damage to our nation.
Jeff, thank you for the call. Again, I just want to reiterate the point that you made, Professor Velty, that, again, we're not looking at a criminal proceeding here.
That's absolutely correct. And it is going to be coming down to what are the facts that we can discern and what are the senators going to do with that in this job interview of the utmost importance here. And the other thing I'd like to mention is that remember that the testimony is under oath. And so people take a promise to tell the truth in front of the Senate under penalty of perjury. And so if you know, Dr. Blasey Ford will come, I mean, women don't lie, first of all. Survivors don't lie, men or women. But they also, because the repercussions of coming forward are so hurtful, harmful, and dangerous. And in addition to that, we have this extra layer of we take an oath to tell the truth under penalty of perjury when we testify.
The other point you made a few minutes ago, I thought it was worth emphasizing. You're saying there's no rush here. The Senate leadership seems to be saying we want to move ahead with a vote, move ahead rather quickly here. You're suggesting something to the opposite.
That's right. When we are talking about placing someone for a lifetime tenure on the Supreme Court, who's generally a young man, right, compared to some of the other justices in terms of age, we should proceed with all due caution and take the time we need. Dahlia Lithwick wrote a great article this week about, you know, the timetable is set by those in power. This is only, quote, too late because Grassley has said this is when we're going to vote. And so those in power set the timetable and decide what's late and what's not. Let's critique that. Let's look at that. Who's setting the timelines and why are they setting them that way? And why don't we want to have the most robust, in-depth process that we can have to make sure all of us feel comfortable when the full Senate votes that they've heard everything they need to hear?
We're talking about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination. How should the U.S. Senate proceed going forward here? That's a topic on the table. Our number, 816-235-2888. L from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Wow. What a moment. Quick thing is, your producer asked, how do I feel? I feel he should withdraw, but the principle being the party, his party or the party of the existing president cannot afford this kind of controversy around a Supreme Court candidate. And unfortunately, a lot of the dinosaurs who sit on the committee are really not listening. But her testimony should and probably will make a huge difference. Victims of abuse don't forget it. And now there's some more information out about him that he was, when he drank, that he was a heavy drinker during that period, and that he became belligerent and very aggressive when he drank.
Again, so I think in fairness to him, Al, I think he said last night that's not the case.
Oh, well, that's fine. And there are other candidates. I mean, there was incidentally a conservative woman judge who is highly qualified that could have been put forward. So there are alternatives for the White House if they choose to recommend somebody else. But his reputation is pretty well stained. And a very smart friend of mine suggested that this would be the issue, or they would be forced to somehow get him out of there and try somebody else.
Al, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
You bet.
Sure. Bye.
Let's keep going here. Martha from Overland Park. Martha, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, in the 80s, I was assaulted by my boss. Hmm. And I got away. I know this happens. And when I confronted him, he said that it would be my word against his. I had to leave my job, and I couldn't tell anyone because I didn't think anyone would believe me. Hmm. And then I thought maybe I was to blame. Maybe I did something, and I didn't. So this man does not belong on the Supreme Court, and this is not ruining his life. He has a job. He has a judgeship to go back to. And if he wanted the truth to come out, he would say, have the FBI come in, have them investigate, have Mark Judge come in and testify for me and speak for me, have all the cards put on the table. But he's not. He just says 17 times last night, I want fair. I want it to be fair. I want it to be balanced. So, no, I don't believe him.
Martha, thank you for the call. I'm sorry to hear about your story. Brenda Bethman, I'm gathering that you've heard similar stories many times before in your work at the UMKC Women's Center here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in fact, this last week, I've heard at least one every day from colleagues and friends and people. So I'm sorry that that happened to you. And
me
thanks
too.
For sharing it.
Yes. Dylan from Raymore. Dylan, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So my position is they should drop this candidate or this nominee, refuse to confirm him and ask the president for another nominee. It's a black eye. If you were in line being interviewed for any job and something like this came up, your employer's responsibility to investigate it, to find out if it's true or not, to try to decide. They're just going to say, thanks for playing. Have a nice day. Let's move on to the next candidate, next nominee. There's no upside in pushing forward on a lame horse. There's no upside to this. There's only potential downside. If you put this guy on the bench and then all of a sudden someone else pops up and it dirties the Supreme Court, and it's not the responsibility of the Senate to investigate this crime. I don't have much of an opinion of whether I, you know, believe him, believe her. Having a background in law enforcement, I do believe that she's got a lot to lose coming out and and, you know, bringing forth this allegation. So I tend to want to believe her. As far as the corroborating witnesses go, from my understanding, his corroborating witness, from what I've heard, had bragged in the past about getting women drunk and getting rough with them. So that makes me think that if he was in the room, then he was probably egging him on.
Right.
And then her witness, well, you know, walking back on her story, you know, when you start getting death threats, you know, you might want to back off of a position, and I could understand that.
Right. So, I'm going to have to move on. I appreciate your phone call and your thoughts. And Professor Velti, I'm wondering, now that this other accuser, Deborah Ramirez, has come forward, how is that going to change the process? I mean, is Christine Blasey Ford somehow more credible now?
Sadly, I think true. I mean, one woman's word should be enough to slow down this process and make sure it's fair and thorough. But that's not how the world works for many reasons. And so the more women that do come forward, the more legitimate the stories will seem. Not that it should be that way, but that's the way we are today.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Maggie from Odessa, Missouri. Maggie, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I only had one comment, and as I think about all of this, and that's, people who drink to excess sometimes drink to the point of oblivion and do not know all the things that they've done. And if nobody tells you that you did something stupid, you don't know that. I guess basically my comment is that she's telling the truth, and she's probably telling the truth, too. He doesn't remember it. Now, the question is, you know the truth from both of them. How are you going to handle it? And see, I don't have an answer for that. My opinion is we already have men in the White House and on the Supreme Court who've done things inappropriately sexually, and they're there, you know.
Right.
So I'm not sure this will keep anybody from being elected or chosen or whatever, but I do think both people could be telling the truth. And how do we deal with that is the question, really.
Right.
That's all I have to say.
Maggie, I'm glad you called. Thank you. And I appreciate the comments. I'm just wondering about looking ahead. It's almost impossible to overlook the fact that we're having this conversation just weeks before midterm elections. Brenda, what impact is this process going to have on women, their enthusiasm, what kind of turnout we might see in November? Are you sensing anything from your perch at UMKC?
I think it will have an effect. My sense from talking to women is that they're pissed off. And it's not just about necessarily this individual nomination, but the whole defense of it as, well, this is something, as Kyle said, or this is something boys do and it's okay and we should overlook it. That's really offensive to say that this is just what boys do and it should be okay and we shouldn't punish them or judge them for it. And it's really disturbing to girls. There's been a lot of conversation about teenage girls and their reaction to it. So if they're talking to their parents too, I think that could have an effect. And I think it might affect turnout.
What are you sensing from your students at the University of Kansas, Professor?
I haven't had the opportunity to speak politics with many of them, so I don't want to speak on their behalf. But I will agree with my colleague here that really I think this Kavanaugh nomination, what's happening now, is really the canary in the mine, so to speak, of larger structural problems that are making women very angry because it's happened to so many of us. And so the other point I'd wanted to make, one of your callers talking about, really the legitimacy of the court itself hangs in the balance here, because we all follow the Supreme Court opinions because we collectively believe even the rule of law as a principle, an organizing principle of our constitutional democracy.
Right.
And so if there's someone on the court that we doubt his integrity or credibility, what does that do to the legitimacy of the opinions that come out of the institution itself for the third branch of government? So that's just a larger structural issue to think about when we're thinking about what does Kavanaugh mean for things larger than himself and Dr. Blasey Ford.
Your point is the court needs credibility to do what it does.
That's right. Credibility is what makes legitimacy happen with Supreme Court opinions.
Lynn says this to us via Twitter. What happened to girls and women years ago still matters today. Powerful people do not escape accountability, and the FBI FBI is a tool available to be sure half the U.S. population is represented by a lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. Tim tweeted this, considering multiple accounts, repeated denials, and the fact that this will be a lifetime appointment to decide court cases about laws, yes, it should disqualify him. Let's go to Eric from Paola. Eric, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a simple question is that when you go in front of Congress and you lie to Congress, you break the law. You've done that. So with Ms. Ford and Kavanaugh, one of them is going to be they're going to believe one or the other. So if they believe Kavanaugh, that's saying Ford's lying. Wouldn't that generate a lawsuit or wouldn't that generate a trial because someone has officially lied to Congress?
Professor, how do you see that playing out in the aftermath of the testimony we might hear on Thursday?
Sure. I mean, certainly lying under oath can lead to perjury charges. Prosecutors have discretion about whether to charge those kinds of things. And so as we've seen, if we go back to the Anita Hill hearings, certainly there was a he said, she said, and the senators chose who they believed and there were no perjury prosecutions. So I highly doubt there would actually be a perjury prosecution, but it certainly is something that is available.
Let me get one more phone call here. Jason from Kansas City, Kansas. Jason, I got about 40 seconds.
Thank you for taking me, Steve. I am a sexual assault survivor. I'm also in law enforcement. I have been for the past 10 years. I have young daughters as well. That being said, I do not believe that this accusation should bar Kavanaugh from being elected to the court. It is simply an accusation at this point. It should be investigated. However, there will always be accusations. Accusations can be brought up by anybody. And although an investigation needs to happen, it should not disqualify Kavanaugh from holding office.
Jason, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Again, I'm sorry to hear about your story. Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Brenda Bethman, director of the UMKC Women's Center, Kyle Velty, an associate professor of law at the University of Kansas. Thank you both for coming in and sharing your views on this very contentious issue. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the women who made flying cool back in the 1920s. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on this program, local author L.L. McKinney shared what inspired her to write a retelling of Alice in Wonderland and why she advocates for more diversity in the literary world. You can find out more at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, she had major roles on beloved TV shows The Office and The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Now she's out with a new book of essays. We chat with author and actor Ellie Kemper about her journey from Missouri to Hollywood. Well, back in the 1920s, when flying was so very young, the hot attraction was airplane racing. These spectacles drew thousands, and cities vied to host them. It probably will come as no surprise that flying was seen as the domain of men. These men were seen as conquering heroes, and women were seen as hopeless wannabes for wanting to horn in on a manly and deadly pursuit. But horn in they did, competing with the men amidst endless ridicule. And finally, they even topped them, breaking what our guest today says was the original glass ceiling. Keith O'Brien tells the story of these women in a much-praised new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Among the five were Amelia Earhart from Atchison, Kansas, and Louise Thaden, who got her start selling coal in Wichita. Keith O'Brien is a former reporter for the Boston Globe and a frequent contributor to NPR. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, and he'll speak in town tonight. More on that in just a little bit. Keith, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Steve, thanks so much.
Female pilots back in the 1920s were about as rare as $1,000 bills raining from the sky. In 1928, among the 29 million women living in the U.S., fewer than a dozen held pilot's licenses, and they were ridiculed, Keith, called all kinds of names like what?
Ladybirds. Sweethearts of the air.
I like petticoat pilots.
Petticoat pilots is a good one. Flying flappers was also popular.
And you went with Fly Girls. That's the title of your book.
Well, Fly Girls has two things going on there. Number one, it was a double entendre from the time. A fly girl in the 1920s was a woman who was breaking with tradition, who was not following the normal cultural paths.
Right.
And number two, you know, they called men flyboys. When Charles Lindbergh showed up on your airfield, he was a flyboy. And that was because there was bravado and gravitas in that title. And so I really wanted to reclaim that gravitas and bravado for these women.
You know, what drew these women then to fly these shaky contraptions? And they were shaky back in those days. They were called airplanes. What drew them?
Well, I mean, number one, they loved it. You know, sailors and aviators will tell you that once you've sailed on the sea or once you've flown, you just love it, and it's a part of you, and it was a part of them too. But the other thing here is what they were trying to achieve. You know, today we take flying for granted. It's at best the easiest way to get from point A to point B. At worst, we complain about it. In the late 1920s, there was magic in aviation, and for these women, if you could prove your equality, if you could prove your ability in the sky, you had done it on the grandest of stages.
So there was an extra incentive for them to do what they did.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, just how precarious a venture was stepping into an airplane and flying it back in those days? It was a whole different deal.
It was. So these planes, by and large, in the late 1920s, were built out of spruce, wood, and linen. Linen stretched tight over the framework of the plane and then lacquered to make it firm. The reason why was because the biggest obstacle to flight was weight, the weight of your airship. And so they wanted to make the planes as light as possible. It's not a surprise, I imagine, to your listeners that these wooden airplanes would often fail. You know, wood would rot underneath that linen. You'd have no idea why. The linen would often tear away without any warning whatsoever. And so, you know, these planes went down at a rate we don't see today.
Yeah.
It simply doesn't happen. And most alarming to me was just how it could happen. You know, at times, entire wings would just fall off or fold back on the fuselage in mid-flight. And of course, when that happened,
not a good thing.
Yeah, the pilot's in big trouble.
I was really struck. Officials back then believed that flying schools should provide a coffin along with the diploma. That was sort of the thinking back then.
That was what the Chicago Tribune declared in 1927. They were so alarmed by what they called wildcat flying schools. You know, flight schools where you could get a pilot's license in just a few hours. And they did say, you know, we might as well give people a coffin when they get a diploma, because that's what they're going to need.
Well, back then, even the change in weather could mean a death sentence if you were up in the air at the time.
You couldn't fly in fog. You couldn't fly in low cloud cover. You couldn't fly in thunderstorms or snow. You couldn't fly at night. There's no GPS. There's no way to know where you were in the sky. Oftentimes, pilots, both male and female, it needed landmarks on the ground in the early days in order to navigate from one place to another.
And railroad tracks was one of those, right?
You would be advised as an aviator that if you got lost, follow the railroad tracks. Find railroad tracks and follow them to the nearest town. At least you'd get your bearings that way. But you know, this sometimes went sideways too. You know, in the late 1920s, pilots sometimes flying low, you know, to get underneath the fog or underneath the storms, following the railroad tracks, would plow their plane right into a railroad tunnel.
You describe rain at one point striking pilots in open cockpits, not unlike bullets hitting flesh. I mean, ouch.
Yeah, they said it would feel like bullets or like a storm of pebbles. You know, you're flying 90 to 100 miles an hour, open cockpit. You know, whatever the elements were, you felt it 100%.
You know, maybe most of all, back then, anytime a woman crashed a plane, it was her fault. When a man crashed the plane, it was a mechanical problem.
That to me was one of the most infuriating things. You know, these women, the characters in my book especially, they were talented and skilled aviators. They knew how to operate a plane. They knew how to fly it fast. And, you know, when they crashed, as inevitably they would, as inevitably the men did too, but when they crashed, they were blamed for it. And to me, that was one of the great injustices.
Keith O'Brien's my guest. His new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History, and he'll be appearing this evening. I'll have more information about that in just a few moments. Were crashes always fatal back in those days?
They were not. A great many of pilots would survive crashes. Indeed, the main characters of my book, they all crashed. They all crashed many times, often over the course of their career, and they often did walk away from it.
You focus on five women, including Amelia Earhart, who wasn't the most skilled pilot of these five, is what you write. Give us quick descriptions of each, if you would, Keith, and let's start with Ruth Nichols. Who was she?
Ruth Nichols was the daughter of Wall Street wealth, born on the Upper East Side of New York and raised in Tony Westchester County on the shores of Long Island Sound. Until 1929 and the stock market crash, Ruth Nichols and her family had money, but she desperately wanted everything that Amelia had.
Louise Faden, who was selling coal in Wichita and was following a follower of boyish pursuits.
So Louise Faden has strong ties to Kansas. Her father was a traveling salesman for mentholatum, and they would ultimately settle in Wichita in the mid-1920s. Louise got a job there selling coal, but what she really wanted to do was fly. And she would find herself wandering to the little airstrip east of town in Wichita, which had been put there and was operated by and large by a man named Walter Beach, who would go on to form Beechcraft.
Sure.
And Walter Beach discovers her there and decides he wants to give Louise a job working in his West Coast distributorship for his first airplane company called Travel Air. And it is this break, you know, Louise getting hired by Walter Beach to go to Oakland and to run his office there, that changes everything for her. She learns how to fly in Oakland and is soon setting records in the sky.
How hard did these women have to work to talk their way into these planes to begin with?
Well, you know, as time would go on and the women would earn the right to race, the women would complain that they couldn't get the fast planes. It's important to point out, you know, both male and female aviators couldn't afford to buy their own planes, especially after the Great Depression set in. These planes would cost $30,000. Today that's over $250,000 in money. Mm-hmm. And so you would need a manufacturer essentially to sponsor you or to give you a plane in order to compete. And the women would complain that they could not get the fast planes, that the manufacturers would not give them the powerful planes.
Let's continue on our list here. Your third woman you focus on in this book, Ruth Elder, who was determined to be the first woman to fly across the Atlantic.
Ruth Elder really begins my narrative in the late summer of 1927. You know, air fever has taken root in America, with Charles Lindbergh having flown solo across the Atlantic in May of 1927. And it is Ruth Elder who breezes onto Long Island in September, just about this time of year, 1927, deciding she wants to be the first woman to fly across the ocean. And, you know, it is a dream for which Ruth Elder will become very famous. By the end of 1927, it is Ruth Elder, not Amelia Earhart. It is Ruth Elder who is the most famous female aviator in this country, and frankly, one of the most famous women, period. But this dream of hers to fly across the ocean is one for which she will also pay a really awful personal price.
Hmm. How about Florence Klingensmith, whose first aviation job was as a stunt girl standing on a wing in her bathing suit, but she may have met the most tragic ending of all here.
So Florence, you know, had to break in a way a lot of women did in these days. You know, she couldn't get she didn't have money to learn how to fly a plane initially, and she didn't have even the opportunity to do so. But she was young, she was daring, and she was, as the men would say, very attractive. And so her first job was as a stunt girl, you know, riding on the wing of a plane. But by the late 1920s, she convinced moneyed men in Fargo, North Dakota, her hometown, to give her $3,000 to get her own plane. Finally, one businessman agrees. He says to her, "You know, if you're willing to risk your neck, I'll risk my money." And so she gets this plane, and she is quickly flying it into the record books. You know, Florence flew in the kind of racing that Amelia Earhart really did not. She flew in what was known as the pylon races, you know, whipping her plane around small towers placed on the ground in a triangular course. Hmm. And as she is competing in one of these races in September 1933, and it's important to point out, she's competing in this race against the men when her plane fails. It's not Florence's fault. She's flying a dangerous plane, a plane that had killed many men before. And in the middle of this flight, her wing begins to disintegrate and falling apart as she's competing. She does exactly as she is supposed to do at this point. You know, she peels off course, flying away from her competitors and the crowd. She's trying to save people on the ground and trying to gain altitude to save herself. It doesn't work. The plane nosedives into a tree nursery just south of the airfield in Chicago. And Florence dies in that field. And, you know, this happened in the air races all the time to the men. And when it did, they were often given grand tributes on the airfield that weekend with flybys and 21-gun salutes, and their ashes even scattered sometimes from a plane while everyone held their hats over their hearts in a moment of silence. You know, Florence does not even get the most basic, decent human respect. She is blamed for this crash in which her wing has failed, and they blame it specifically on what they called her, quote, weakened condition. In the autopsy, they find that Florence Klingensmith was menstruating at the time. She was on her period. And they blame her death not on the wing failing, but on the fact that she was menstruating. And, you know, while this might sound, you know, absurd to listeners today, and while I certainly found it infuriating, in 1930, the U.S. Department of Commerce, which was the regulating agency at the time for aviation, declared it unsafe. They wrote this into their rules. It was unsafe for a woman to fly within 3 days of her period. I mean, it is a stunning thing to think that one of the greatest aviators, male or female, in this country in 1933 would be blamed for a crash in which it was clearly obvious that the wing had failed.
Keith O'Brien's my guest. He'll be discussing Fly Girls, how five daring women defied all odds and made aviation history at 7 o'clock tonight at the Linda Hall Library, 5109 Cherry Street. The event is co-sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. More information on the Rainy Day Books website. You know, on Twitter yesterday, Keith, I couldn't help but notice you posted a picture of Amelia Earhart's childhood dining room in Atchison up in Kansas. And you wrote this: "There are no words to describe how I felt in this room signing these books. No words." Why did you feel that way? Because Amelia Earhart's the fifth woman you focus on in this book.
Of course. Yeah, so you can't write about women in aviation in the 1920s and 30s without writing about Amelia Earhart. And I just want to be very clear. You know, my story here is the story of an ensemble cast. These women were friends. You know, they were close.
And competitors.
Absolutely. But, you know, this isn't, you know, some comprehensive history of aviation and women in the 1920s and 30s. This is really one specific story about a handful of friends who fought against the greatest of odds. And, you know, Amelia Earhart is at the heart and soul of that story. She was one of the most famous women in this country at this time, and certainly the most famous female aviator by the mid-1930s. Getting back to your question, Steve, you know, having lived inside this story for 2.5 years, you know, researching this, writing this, you know, I feel like I know these women.
Yeah.
You know, they're a part of me. And to be in Atchison, this, and to visit her childhood home on the banks of the Missouri River, where she lived in the most formative years of her childhood, was just a very powerful experience.
Yeah, sure.
And you, I think a lot of people feel that when they go there, but you know, to really know Amelia and everything she endured is to really appreciate that it did begin in the small town of Atchison, Kansas.
You know, these races you're talking about, what gave rise to them and why did they become so popular, Keith?
So the aviation industry was very worried about all the negative press it would receive when planes would crash or when the Chicago Tribune would write, if you're going to get a flight school diploma, you should might as well get a coffin. That was obviously not good marketing for the aviation industry. So in 1928, they decided to make the air races, which had been happening in some way, shape, or form for many years, much more modern. And these first air races were held in a bean and barley field just south of downtown Los Angeles. We know this bean and barley field today by three letters. It is LAX.
No,
the future site of LAX was where they held the 1928 air races, and it was a massive affair. You know, 10 days, huge crowds, and they really wanted to show what planes could do. Not like our air shows today, although they certainly did have some acrobatics and things like that. You know, they wanted to show it with real races.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it created excitement. It created marketable heroes like Charles Lindbergh and Jimmy Doolittle, Benny Howard, Roscoe Turner, these male pilots who really were the LeBron Jameses of their day. You know, the big athletes whose names filled the newspapers.
They became that popular, literally hundreds of thousands of people showing up for these things.
Yeah, on the biggest days, 125,000 paying fans. Just as many would watch for free from the hoods of their automobiles parked on nearby highways. 500,000 fans in a single weekend. And, you know, the cities would vie against one another for the right to host the races in the way cities today do to host the Super Bowl.
Wow.
That's how big it was, because to be a city hosting the air races wasn't just an economic boon to the town. It proved that you were a futuristic modern city, you know, an air-minded town in an air-minded time.
Now, I've got about a minute left. There was this big contest, Keith, called the Bendix Trophy Race. What was it and why was it such a big deal? And just briefly, what happened in 1936?
The Bendix Trophy Race was, as the aviators would say, the World Series of its time. It was a transcontinental speed race that would leave, say, from New York and end at the terminus of the air races in Los Angeles. And, you know, it was like a 12-hour race in the sky with multiple planes jockeying to get there first for a $10,000 jackpot of money. You know, it's a lot of money during the Great Depression. And, you know, this was believed to be the domain of men. And until 1933, only men compete in the Bendix. Starting then, however, a few women begin to compete. And in 1936, three women, including two of my main characters, will compete in the Bendix. And one of them will beat the men in one of the most celebrated races of them all.
Keith O'Brien talks about all of this exciting story. Fly Girls is the book, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. He'll be speaking this evening at 7 at Linda Hall Library, 5109 Cherry Street. The event is co-sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. Go to the bookstore website for more information. Keith, it's a fascinating story. Thanks so much for sharing it with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, Missouri native turned Hollywood star Ellie Kemper. She'll be with us. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.